My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagratz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about a world without the West. Hi, Balder. Why are we talking about a world without the West? Did anything happen this week that would lead us to talking about a topic like this?
Hello, Dario. You're setting me up there. Obviously, what happened was the BRICS summit in itself, which has plenty of content to analyze and to talk about. The BRICS as an organization that's increasingly an alternative to Western-dominated politics. But in general, you could argue that every week, that every month that passes is a week and month where the West is declining in its influence, is declining in its relationships with the rest of the world. As a result, we're moving ever faster towards a world where that Western dominance we are so used to is no longer visible.
Do we need to quickly explain BRICS? I mean, I'll do it just for the sake of it. All right, the BRICS is an international organization, I think we can call it. And it stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Formerly, it was known as just BRIC, and then they added South Africa at the end. And I think by now they're officially called BRICS Plus because Ethiopia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates have also joined recently. And I mean, how would you put them into context to other international organizations?
Well, that actually, it started off slightly differently than what it is now, how we look at it nowadays, right? It was basically a way within the UN framework for these original countries, without South Africa at the time, just Brazil, Russia, India, and China. It's nice if an organization has the acronym of the countries, because you can always remember who's in there. Those four countries that were clearly and are still very much on the rise, that were seen as not part of the Western framework, how they could cooperate globally, financially, etc., etc. The thing that has changed since then, and not just South Africa joining, but also at the beginning of this year, Iran, for example, joining, which was, of course, a huge upset to Western powers who want to isolate Iran, is that it's more and more become synonymous with that decline of the West. So even though before it was just four countries saying, how can we work together, and how, because we are major powers, but we're not part of the old boys network run by Washington, London, Paris, its rise in influence has gone in parallel with the decline of Western influence. And as a result, it is often seen as sort of a competitor to Western geopolitical dominance. It is not directly so, and in principle, in theory, they should be able to work hand in hand, right? Western interest and BRICS interest shouldn't be necessarily in contrast with each other, but that's what it more and more is looking like.
They started out as, right, kind of saying, hey, we are emerging economies, particularly India, China and Brazil, right? And they were also coined as in the early 2000s as like, oh, these are the next big players. And I think they were right in at least some of these cases. And then we, exactly as you said, it kind of went into the direction of, is this kind of like the opposite of what the West is striving for, right? The BRICS are advocating for a multipolar world where there will not be one hegemon, the West and the United States, but there will be different centers of power, and we're kind of, these centers of power will have to coexist and they will have to talk to each other. And that's what that format is for. And that's very much what you hear from that format, right? Kind of coming out of that is that, hey, we're just looking for a platform to talk to each other, to kind of sort out our differences that also we have amongst each other, right? I mean, it's really difficult to find the common denominator between Brazil, Russia, China, India, and South Africa. But in the Western perception, I'm not sure whether this is actually what it means. I mean, I've heard uninformed friends kind of calling it an alternative to NATO, and kind of something that's there to kind of kick the West kind of out of the ruling club and kind of replace the liberal democratic system and the liberal world order that we live in.
Well, that's how it's increasingly being framed, and to a certain extent, there is some truth to that, right? In the sense, it's not so. when it was set up, it was at a time that there was still a unipolar world. It was at the end of the unipolar world, but it was still there. And it was just these four countries saying, hey, you know what? How can we survive in a world dominated by Washington? But then what you noticed is because they never had that initial aim to become a geopolitical power, it was simply how can we, as four important but not dominant countries, how can we work together? They became a relatively benign option for the rest of, if you like, the developing world, the rest of what sometimes is kind of uncomfortably referred to as the global south, to say, hey, you know what? These are countries that are open to collaboration without imposing all the Western moral frameworks that we have been suffering under, right? So it became like a liberating force for countries that felt that they were being oppressed by Western liberalism, Western democracy, etc., etc. And in that sense, China, nowadays Russia, and India saw an opportunity to say, we can offer a new model to these countries. We can show that, yes, we are probably geopolitically more influential than they are. So, for example, China is obviously a more powerful country than, let's say, Uganda. But we can work with them in a way that is not dictating their ideology, that is not dictating how they should behave on the world stage, but that is mutually beneficial for both. And as such, it is kind of organically becoming that competitor against the Western interest without necessarily overtly doing that, right? It is basically a place where countries can feel safe from what they often perceive as Western oppression.
So just like most other international organizations, the BRICS countries meet once a year. And this year it happened to be in Russia, in Kazan. And that made it, according to Western media, controversial, right? I would say there is a point to be made, right? Russia made the conscious decision to basically invade another sovereign nation, something that under the international law that we have, something according to the UN, we don't like, and rightfully so, right? So Russia violated that principle of sovereignty. And now kind of 3 years after that initial kind of impact, there's this summit happening in Russia and people are attending. So yeah, there was a bit of, right before it was deemed controversial, and I think it still is, right, by Western media, of course. But I think as a surprise to some, actually more countries attended than initially expected, right? So not only did a few more countries join the BRICS, so the BRICS Plus, joining an international organization with Russia. I mean, that's is that someone you want to associate yourself with? But also a lot of countries this year attended, so a little over 30, where a lot of them said, okay, we actually want to become part of the BRICS, or maybe we're just associated members now, but we definitely want to be there. And we come and basically shake Putin's hand on the world stage, and that creates the according images.
Yes, and what is crucial here is that it shows the problem, and if you want to be, you know, controversial, or you want to be aggressive, you could say the idiocy of Western foreign policy. Because in theory, the world rejecting the invasion of Ukraine should not be a geopolitical issue. It should just be a global system issue. You said it goes against international law. I would argue that it goes much deeper than that. It goes against the very foundation, the principle of the system as it is, beyond any conventions that we call law. The only thing we can cling on to is territorial sovereignty. And Russia broke that. So that shouldn't be a political or geopolitical issue. It should be that every other member of the United Nations rejects that behavior. But because the West immediately made it about good versus evil, immediately made it about a fight between democratic, free, liberal Ukraine against evil, authoritarian, dictatorial Putin and Russia, the rest of the world felt that this was not something that concerned them. And you see a lot of disinterest in the war in Ukraine exactly because of that. Not because a country like South Africa doesn't care about the invasion of Ukraine. They don't like Russia invading. China didn't like Russia invading. But because the West forces them to turn it into some kind of political issue, you're either with us or you're against us. And that's exactly why the BRICS exist. Those countries do not want to make the choice. They do not want to have to choose for the West. And going to Russia, therefore, is a much less loaded question for non-Western countries, because they feel that the war in Ukraine is a conflict that doesn't really concern the global community. It is a conflict between the West and Russia. And that's a huge mistake, right? I mean, if you're a Western policymaker, you want South Africa and India and China to feel connected to the conflict in Ukraine. And you want to put it into a context of, hey, we don't have anything against Moscow, we don't have anything against Putin, but we have something against one sovereign nation invading another sovereign nation. It's been a huge blunder by Western foreign policymakers.
I absolutely agree. And I think time, as you said, is an important factor here, right? It's now been 2.5 years. And I think for the initial first year, that was very successful. And we talked about this in this podcast quite a few times, right? The different votes in the UN General Assembly condemning the invasion, where it kind of became like consistently fewer countries voting in favor of Western proposed resolutions. So initially you had that effect of countries saying, oh, hey, territorial integrity, let's not violate that. We don't want to have that violated ourselves. And then you had Russia for about a year being very, very isolated and kind of added to the axis of evil, right? If that's still a thing. So Iran, okay, North Korea and Russia, Venezuela, those are the four bad guys kind of sticking together, right? From a Western perception. And that has changed recently, because now you have an additional 30 countries in that corner. And I think you're going to have a difficult time depicting them all as the bad guys. And here's a hypothesis of mine of why that is different. It's partly obviously time, but there's another thing that happened in the last year, and that is the whole situation surrounding Israel, right? Is where, I mean, if you look at it on a blank piece of paper, there are similarities between the behavior of Israel in Gaza and the behavior of Russia in Ukraine. I mean, I don't want to kind of put them right on the exact same, but there are similarities in the behavior, right? So there's one very powerful kind of military might that's attacking another player. And I think this became even more evident in the last month when then Israel decided to start a quote-unquote ground incursion in Lebanon, right? We've talked about this and quickly laughed at it and then called it an invasion. However, the West is still on Israel's side and kind of is encouraging Israel by not speaking out louder against it, of continuing that behavior. So that's the exact same dynamic, right? You have Russia invading Ukraine, you have Israel invading Lebanon. But in the one case, the West is still standing with one of the players. And in the other case, the West is going very much against that. And I think that this hypocrisy that is so evident is one of the reasons why 30 plus countries attended the summit and now no longer have the same problem kind of being seen together with Putin than they had 2 years ago.
That's exactly it, because in their mind, from their perspective, this has nothing to do with global order. It's got to do with Western interest and the West being the West. It's got to do with who the West perceives as a friend and who they perceive as an enemy. And South Africa, I'm just using South Africa as a random example. South Africa is something like, we don't have to be dictated by the West who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. If Washington, if European nations had portrayed Russia's invasion of Ukraine in universal terms, then of course the automatic corollary of that would have to be that they would also condemn Israel invading Lebanese territory. You can argue about Gaza, you can argue about whether the Palestinian state is actually a Westphalian state or not, okay, that's a different thing. But the moment that Israel invades Lebanon against the wishes of the Lebanese government, then that is exactly the same problem as what Russia did in Ukraine. And because the West doesn't make that distinction and the West isn't consistent, you called it hypocritical, which I think is a fair word to use here. Because of that, the rest of the world doesn't feel emotionally or practically connected to this moral outrage that the West expresses about having BRICS in Russia, having meeting Putin or doing business with Putin, because it is just seen as something that involves Washington's interest rather than humanity's interest, so to speak.
And ultimately for the countries attending, I mean, what is this summit about? It's about making connections with other world leaders who are in a similar situation to you, or if you're talking about China and India, who are in a position that could be beneficial to you soon, right? If you trade with them, if you deepen relations. So, and that's usually the outcome of these summits, right? Is that there's not some big policy announced. And I would say that's also not the interest of anyone there, except, and here I would single out Putin, who kind of said, oh, we want to put forward an alternative payment system, right, to the dollar, which, I mean, that one also makes sense from their perspective, because if basically for ideological reasons, you're being punished by the West every few minutes with sanctions kind of revolving around the dollar, then that does make sense. But even that part, right, wasn't as concrete in the end. It was basically saying, well, we want to kind of get away from the dollar, but there wasn't an alternative system put forward. And that's one of Putin's mind games.
Yeah, and this is one of those issues that's been on his wish list forever, but has lots of practical problems. It's very difficult to implement something that doesn't come organically, right? You know, just the fact that they would really love to have an alternative to the dollar doesn't mean that it's easy to get that alternative. It's not like simply a different system. It's also having enough clients who want to be part of that system. But to be fair, it's also something that's been on the wish list of Beijing for a long time, right? There is a real discomfort with the dollar giving such a huge advantage to the United States. And it does, right? It basically makes, for those people who maybe never thought about this, it provides a lot of geopolitical power to the United States, but also gives very direct economic benefits. It makes printing money much cheaper for the United States because inflation is spread out all over the world and not just for the US economy, right? Whereas if China prints money, then that will lead to domestic inflation because they don't have that effect that the dollar has. So there are loads of reasons why Russia, China, and maybe in the future India feel very uncomfortable with this reality. But initiatives to counter that are actually very hard to turn into a success. And I think it's more a symbolic issue than that it will have any practical impact.
Well, and then it's very interesting what Western media focuses on when reporting about these. I mean, first of all, right, so for transparency, it's Friday morning, right, the 25th of October. And I did the same thing as every morning, and on Fridays a little bit more intensely because we are recording. I open the news, right, all the different pages you can imagine, particularly Western media. And I was actually searching on the landing pages for anything regarding the BRICS, and I couldn't really find anything. And then I went on to Google them, and then you would find these articles. And the focus was always on controversial summit. People are shaking Putin's hand. Then it was on this alternative payment system and how it's basically not working. So what is the summit even about? And that's it, right? And then there's another conclusion that was taken out of the summit, but that one we will talk about in a few minutes. That one concerns North Korea. And that's an entirely different picture to what we then see in non-Western media, right? So, I don't know, Times of India or the Global Times, which is, I think we can call it Chinese state propaganda, right? And there, the emphasis is a lot more on the cooperation aspect and kind of saying, hey, we've had the opportunity again to kind of quickly talk about a few topics, also maybe to sort out some differences and to really advance forward, right? There was not this talk of controversial summit and we are trying to change the world. And I mean, it's more about, hey, in a increasingly multipolar world, we need more communication with each other because that's good and it's going to avoid conflict and nobody wants war.
And in many ways, this is a team building exercise that the West doesn't seem to understand, right? It very often you can see the behavior of states, governments are represented by specific people, exactly in the same way that you see just people within an organization cooperating. And in this case, a summit like this is a way for these countries to chat with each other, to have lunch with each other, to ask each other about how they're doing, and then to say, hey, next week or next month, let's have a bilateral conversation about X, or let's meet with the three of us about why, right? So the point of the summit is never to come up with really new ideas or new initiatives. And the West doesn't seem to understand the importance of what's happening in front of their eyes. It's not some kind of conspiracy that Western media try to hide it from the public. It's just that Western media don't connect to this reality that is very clearly visible to media around the world, namely how liberating it is to have meetings without having Europeans or North Americans telling them what to do. How liberating it is not to be confronted with hypocritical discourses about human rights or about demanding loyalty or anything like that. And as a result, these summits are typically a success, even if they don't produce anything concrete. The fact that the West and Western media do not report on this and seem to misinterpret the point, put it in the context of Putin is getting away with murder, or however they want to put it onto their headlines, is very worrying if you are someone who would like the West to do well. And we very much do, right? I can't repeat this enough. In many ways, this podcast is a love letter to the West. It's like tough love, like get a grip, do better, because otherwise you're slipping away and you're gonna lose out in the future. And so the West being unable to connect to these dynamics and not understanding what is happening is a really bad sign for the future of Western foreign policy.
Absolutely, because I mean, there was a very concrete example of two countries kind of hugging it out on the global stage, and that's China and India, who, I mean, they're China and India not aligned on many topics. I mean, they're very much, right, I would say, also in their own nature, strategic rivals. They also are bordering each other, and there's a lot of tensions at that border because it's not clearly defined. And for the last three, almost 4 years, they were actually not on great talking terms because of exactly this, right? Because of border skirmishes between border guards, right? Where on different occasions soldiers died, like during border fights, and that put a real strain on their relationship. But what do these two countries understand is that, well, in today's world, we do not have any need for additional tensions. We understand that this is hurtful to us, so let's kind of work together to overcome these differences. That's what they did, right? They kind of announced, there wasn't any clear kind of agreement in the end, but they kind of announced, well, we're going to take it down a notch and we're actually going to work together, because we need to focus on carving out space for us in this new multipolar world, while kind of keeping our populations at check, right? Because, I mean, it's really like, hey, both of the populations are really riled up usually against each other. And so kind of you need to sometimes take it down a little bit, de-escalate things, and tell your populations that everything is fine. Don't worry, we're keeping them in check.
Yes, knowing how humanity behaves, India and China seem to be prime targets for a hardcore rivalry along the lines of historically, if you like, Germany and France, or, you know, when you share a border like that, then there's between two major powers, there is this automatic inherent tension. You mentioned populations, populations on the border, literally border guards, right? India and China agreed to take away weapons from border guards because they would too often shoot at each other. Then after taking away those weapons, what happened is that they started, literally a group of Chinese border guards pushed a number of Indian border guards into a ravine, killing them. I think about 20 of them, if I recall correctly, about 10 years ago, whenever this was. These two countries seem prime targets for a rivalry that could be, if you like, geopolitically exploited by others, right? And yet that is not what we're seeing. An interesting parallel there would be, have you ever considered what history would have looked like if Luxembourg, Dario, had stretched all the way to the Alps, to Switzerland? If there hadn't been a border between France and Germany, I mean, 20th century history would have been completely different as a result, right? So the fact that rivalry between India and China, the border is relatively small between them, but it is there. And the geopolitical interests clearly in theory don't align, but what they have in common is this desire to be taken seriously and be free from the dominance of Western actors. And as such, the fact that they can actually talk to each other in this way, and that specifically the centralized governments are interested in collaboration and are actively working at keeping their populations at bay, is a sign, once again, that should be very worrying to Washington and Paris and London. And the way to react to that is not by saying, they are now also part of the axis of evil. The way to react to that is by understand how this is possible. What is it that makes China rather want to cooperate with India, or India rather cooperate with China than with the United States, for example, right? That doesn't make any sense theoretically. And the explanation, of course, is that the world is completely, completely tired of this Western discourse. And a similar pattern can be seen with other rivals around the world, right? How is it possible that Turkey, Iran, and Russia are forming a geopolitical triangle at the moment in the region? These three countries are historically completely at odds with each other. And yet now they're dominating the region, and Tehran, Ankara, and Moscow are actively working together. How did that ever happen? Those are the questions that we should be asking ourselves.
Absolutely, and we're not, because instead there is a very big topic, basically the only topic that Western media, and I would also say Western policymakers, focused on coming out of the summit, and that's it, that now we basically have confirmation that there are North Korean troops in Ukraine. Right, so for context, about a week ago, at least a week ago, I heard about it for the first time. There were rumors that North Korea was sending about 3,000 soldiers to Russia and that they were going to be active in Ukraine. And then at the BRICS summit, at the closing press conference, Putin was asked about it, that, based on satellite imagery, there are North Korean troops in Russia. And he said, if the satellites say that, then I don't know. Probably, maybe, right? So clearly not denying it, which marks, if you believe Western media, a new stage of escalation in the conflict, because these 3,000 North Koreans are obviously going to tip the scale towards Russia. But it kind of shows you that instead of focusing on China and India, the West is focusing on 3,000 North Koreans who are now in Eastern Ukraine.
Which again, it only reinforces this picture that we've just been painting. It is this myopic approach to the world where somehow we assume that the whole world looks at these countries and these events in the way that we do. So the West has decided for a very long time that North Korea are on the naughty list. By the way, for the record, I've got zero sympathy for North Korea. I don't think that it's a particularly well-functioning regime, but the West believes that it's a universal truth that North Korea somehow are a core source of evil. For a country like, once again, South Africa, it is an irrelevant question. They're not interested in dealing with North Korea. They're not interested in dealing with whether Pyongyang is somehow a force for good or force for evil in the world. It's not relevant to their reality. And the West assuming that somehow it must be outrageous to everyone that North Korean troops are supporting the Russian war in Ukraine is just not understanding the realities of the world. At the same time, by the way, how many resources, military resources, how many volunteers from Britain, from the United States, have actually gone to fight in Ukraine. Now, we would be upset if South Africa says something about that, right? We would not want South Africa to be angry about that. So why is it that they're supposed to be angry now about North Korea doing something similar? It is a really disturbing sign of the times that the Western media, as well as Western politicians, don't understand this disconnect that exists between our perception of the world and the rest of the world's perception of itself.
But it is interesting what's happening, right? First of all, that Russia and North Korea are now on such good terms that they're basically exchanging soldiers for money, technology. It kind of shows how desperate Russia is in certain areas. But also that North Korea is willing to do this. And maybe this is even a positive example for others.
Yeah, no, and I don't know if it's really an act of desperation, in the sense that I think Russia is probably at this stage the most comfortable in the war as it has ever been for the past 2 years, right? I mean, it stabilized the front, and it's not, obviously the Kremlin is not happy with the lack of success, because it's not been a successful war in any way for Russia. But I think that the invitation of getting North Korean troops in is very much a diplomatic move. Exactly as you say, it is a way for both North Korea and for Russia to say, hey, we're working together in a way that we are not beholden to the powers that be. Read Western influence, right? And what you see is that a lot of countries are actually interested in kind of copying that idea. Not that a lot of countries are interested in getting involved in the war with Ukraine, because most countries reject the invasion of Ukraine. But it is that they are seeing, hey, you know what, we can work with Russia and it might be beneficial for us, and Russia also gets something out of it, and it's not actually going to lead to us being punished by the international community, because the international community is no longer controlled as it used to be by Washington or by European capitals. It's no longer something that we have to fear. So in many ways, I think it's quite a clever move by Putin to say, hey, you know what, the West, you know who they really hate? They really hate North Korea. Look, we've just invited North Korea in, and there's no reaction beyond just a few newspapers and a few politicians complaining about it. This means that you are free to actually move on with your own life without that control that you've been shackled by for such a long time.
Well, and I mean, I think that there's few countries that could do this. I think particularly the ones who are already suffering from Western sanctions. So Iran, Venezuela, North Korea. I think with other countries, I still think they would think twice, because, I mean, yes, the international community is not going to impose sanctions, but the West still will. So it depends a little bit on how good your relationship is with the West, which is something I think we actually saw with Saudi Arabia during the summit, because they were invited to join as a member, but the Saudis said, no, we would much rather take a 400 billion weapons deal with the United States. Thank you very much. So I still think that you kind of have to be an outlier already to kind of consider the North Korean model as a success story.
Well, but this is one of the things where international relations get really fascinating, but also complex, right? The Saudi case is a exception to the rule in many ways, because what happens before October last year, Iran and Saudi Arabia were actually getting much closer together. They were opening consulates. They were, you know, and that was unheard of previously. Once again, a sign.
And that was negotiated by the Chinese, right?
Indeed, exactly. And so one of the forces, and the Chinese as one of the main forces of the BRICS, trying to once again say, hey, you know what, you can do things differently. You don't have to continuously fall into these patterns, because the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia was never particularly, you know, it never led to any positive outcomes. I mean, it had Saudi Arabia wants to position itself as leader of the Arab world, and then Iran is a good target for not being Arab. It was never particularly fruitful. And it's very much in line with what you're seeing with the BRICS in general, is that then China comes in and say, hey, we need to deal with both of you. We are happy to do that, but we can only do that if you stop this rivalry between each other. And that was the way they were heading. Then October last year happens, and all of a sudden Saudi Arabia becomes the main target for the United States to get back on board. And that back on board means alienating Iran once again and getting it. And so the United States becomes extremely generous towards Saudi Arabia. And they need to, because without Saudi Arabia, their whole policy in the Middle East then collapses. So in that sense, Saudi Arabia is the exception. But what you're actually seeing right now is a major, major issue that the West has lost interest in, is what happens to West Africa. In West Africa, Russia is becoming the dominant military power because of the Wagner Group that's been there, Burkina Faso and Mali, we've talked about it in previous episodes before the summer, have changed their governance systems, have become controlled by military juntas, and Russia is supportive of these countries with Chinese input. And now the big question for other African Union countries is, what happens if we now start doing business with them? Because that would indirectly be doing business with Russia. And what you see at a diplomatic level is that there's this realignment and this checking, like, how far can we go before Washington or Europe become aggressive against us? And what Russia is very well exposing, and this is basically signaling to Nigeria, to South Africa, to Kenya, you know what? The West is toothless. They are overstretched. They can't deal with Israel and Ukraine and anything else. Look at what we're doing with North Korea. This would be blasphemy. This would be impossible to do 10 years ago. But we can do it now because the West is not capable of keeping its own backyard clean, let alone messing with your foreign policy. And so this move with North Korea is basically a signal to that Moscow wants to give out to other BRICS countries, other major players regionally, saying, do what you want in West Africa, do what you want elsewhere, it's not going to hurt you.
It's very interesting. That's a perspective I hadn't considered yet, particularly with West Africa. Thank you very much for bringing that up, because I think it fits even better into the overall theme of this episode, right? Kind of saying that, well, this is a world without the West. And yeah, the West is incredibly overstretched in a lot of areas. And therefore, it can no longer take care of its, well, backyard, right? I mean, our listeners know what this terminology means. But basically, right, very close to home, a lot closer than the North Korea.
It's how the West also perceives it, right? I mean, it's not an acknowledgement that Ukraine or Israel or the Middle East are actually belong to the West, but the West believes those areas to be their sphere of influence, believes those areas to be their backyard, and they can't control in that sense what they consider their backyard. And if they can't do that, then that is a real sign of changing times.
There was a very interesting op-ed in one of the German newspapers I read, and it was basically about German foreign policy the other day. It was a little bit in combination with a climate topic, not so much, well, but the climate topic, in my opinion, is very closely connected in the Western mind with the liberal democratic model. And it basically criticized the current government, right, where the foreign ministry is run by the Green Party, where the kind of change in foreign policy a few years ago was, when they came into power, was that we basically have a value-driven foreign policy now, that we need to be strict towards China, we need to point out things. And that this is not only a communication style that the foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, employs, but this is also now going through to the diplomats, right? Very much in line with the Western with the Western bubble there, where diplomats now are encouraged to kind of walk around and go into meetings and kind of whack the finger and saying that, you know what? You're not doing enough on the climate level, and the democracy part is also not looking so good, right? And it's very much in line with that overall Western image, right? Is that diplomats are no longer focused on strategic issues such as what's the presence of Russia looking like in quote unquote the Western backyard, but it's more about, well, are you really collecting all your brownie points with the West? Are you going to be on the naughty list or on the nice list?
And that is exactly how they get it almost perfectly wrong, right? So I don't think any sensible person would be against a value-driven foreign policy in terms of you sticking in your own behavior to your own values. And, you know, and that means sometimes forgoing a contract with Saudi Arabia, which might give you billions of euros or billions of dollars, but you feel uncomfortable because of the ethical implications. But what the West does is not using the concept of value-driven policy to limit their own ability to work with the rest of the world. Basically say, hey, sometimes we feel uncomfortable doing something with the country because we feel uncomfortable with specific policy, so we won't do it. No. It's about judging any other country for not behaving in the way that the West believes they should behave, which is, of course, insanity. Who is the West to demand that? So if the West says, we don't want a contract with Russia, or we don't want a contract with China because we have a problem with the way that China or Russia behaves, that's perfectly fine. But who is the West to tell India, you cannot deal with Russia or you cannot deal with China? That is not up to the West. That is up to India and their own value system.
See, here I have to bring up my own country again, Germany, because it just fits so well right now. Another example from the last week is that the German government basically signed off on on weapons exports to Israel worth 100 million. And then to kind of counter that, because you kind of feel bad about it, they also sent 100 million euros in humanitarian aid to Lebanon, you know, right? Because, okay, we'll destroy things worth 100 million, then we will rebuild them worth 100 million. And that's our value-driven foreign policy.
Yeah, I've never understood how people can look themselves in the mirror without just, you know, falling on the floor laughing when they argue that it's very important morally to contain Iran because of the situation of women in Iran, which, by the way, is a very fair point to bring up, versus where we're happy to receive billions and billions of from Saudi Arabia. You're not telling me that Saudi Arabia in its governance system or in its human rights record is not in the same league as Iran from a Western perspective. So either you say, hey, you know what, we just don't want to do business with anyone we feel uncomfortable with, which means foregoing a lot of contracts, or you say, well, it's not up to us to judge. We will work with everyone. But don't tell me that you're not going to work with Iran, but you are going to work with Saudi Arabia. That is the most inconsistent, hypocritical perspective that you can imagine.
Yeah, very much. And I mean, hey, if we look at the behavior of other players in the world, it theoretically is very consistent with their behavior, right? So there's a lot of players out there that are playing both sides, right? I mean, Russia is a great example between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Turkey is a great example of a player that always plays both sides. But the difference here is, right, the whacking of the finger is that, yeah, that's, I mean, right, that's, I would say, the ultimate form of realism, given that we're talking about international relations. Just with the extra added element of hypocrisy with the West that has just, I would say, destroyed a lot of relations between the West and other countries in the past few years and made them incredibly fed up. And then, well, you know, might as well look over to Kazan, to Russia, and let's see if we can attend this BRICS summit, because a lot of people are exchanging a lot of interest there and are trying to kind of get rid of conflicts, find new economic opportunities, and so on and so forth.
Well, and one of the things, and it's, by the way, one of the things how I make money, is to try to explain to Western policymakers or Western civil servants or diplomats how liberating it is for countries to not have that finger being whacked at them, to basically be able to work with China without China telling you how to run your own country, to be able to work with India, to be able to work with Brazil, or to be able to work with Russia without those potential economic and maybe even geopolitical partners being interested in your human rights records, being interested in your values and whether your values are democratic enough or liberal enough. It seems that Western policymakers, and I see this almost on a weekly basis, in practice, I mean, are not at all aware of how oppressive they come across and they have come across for all those years, and how neocolonial it feels to the rest of the world, how it feels that it is not a fair relationship with them the moment that finger is being whacked at them. And then they all of a sudden meet Chinese diplomats and they feel liberated, because at no moment in that conversation did the Chinese ask, okay, so are you actually going to have elections tomorrow or not? The Chinese don't care.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on a world without the West. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, as we've argued, that in many ways, the rise of the BRICS and the rise of non-Western powers in general, sort of the void that is left behind by the West and is now being taken up by China and India and Russia and others, is in many ways a sign of a decaying empire, right? It's the sign of the decline of the West. We don't know where it's going to end up. We don't know if the West will collapse or not, but we do know that the West is on the decline, and it's very evident statistically, and it's evident from these kinds of conversations. And that made me think of the fall of the Roman Empire. As we know, men often think about the Roman Empire, apparently, and specifically the seminal work, which is like a very famous work on this by Edward Gibbon, right, which is called The Decline and the Fall of the Roman Empire. And he wrote, "There exists in human nature a strong propensity to depreciate the advantages and to magnify the evils of the present times."